So I would argue we're actually going the opposite direction. I'm not so sure we are muscles getting healthier over the generations, because simply the inactivity prevalence is higher and higher. You can see this in kids, in 15-year-olds. There are studies also in Belgium that the physical activity amount and also just the performance is going down.
Beatnik. Let's talk about health. Conversations about topics that improve your well-being.
You're about to hear a conversation with Dr. Gomor Dulst from the Laboratory of Exercise and Health at ETH Zurich, Switzerland. I'm Peter Bietenholz, your host and founder of Beatnik, a Los Angeles-based company that powers positive behavioral health. Next to our podcast, we also have an extensive blog on our website and social media at Beatnik with over 1,400 science-based entries that covers all aspects of health and well-being. Make sure to check it out and follow us there as well. I'm excited to welcome Dr. Gomor Dulst from the Laboratory of Exercise and Health at ETH Zurich. Thanks for coming. It's a pleasure to have you here. When I prepared for this podcast, I realized that the skeletal muscle connection is not something that is featured prominently in the mainstream media or even on health and fitness related platforms, which is strange considering its importance and that we probably wouldn't be able to get out of bed every morning without that connection working properly. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about yourself. What has your journey in science been so far? And of course, in particular, what made you or when did you decide to study muscles?
Yes, Peter, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. Very nice studio that you arranged. So yes, I'm Gomor Dulst. I'm a Belgian. I've been born in Lier, close to Antwerp. And yeah, I've been involved in sports actually my whole life. I've played at a very high level golf, actually a sport that you would not think that I would play if you see me, but actually I played golf at a high level. I went to a specific school for that,
and we almost also, muscles for golf.
in that time I was not that muscular actually, but we did a lot of. Of fitness next to golf, so I was always getting into it. And then I decided not to pursue my golfing career. So I was close to. I went to America for seven months, contemplating should I go to college. The typical thing that Europeans do is they go to college in America to pursue a golfing career. I didn't do it, and I went to college in Belgium. I studied sports sciences there in Leuven, which is, let's say, the biggest university or one of the biggest universities in Belgium. And of course, I was super intrigued by just sports, by exercise, by health from the get-go. But most importantly, because of my typical story about because of my teacher, my professor related to exercise physiology. So in the master's the third year, we received a very nice lecture related to everything that is involved in how the body moves and how the different organs are affected by movement, and most importantly, how the cardiovascular system is affected by exercise. So exercise physiology. So I decided to pursue a PhD in that area. So I joined the Laboratory of Exercise Physiology at KU Leuven, did a PhD there for 5.5 years, where I studied the effects of high altitude on muscle mass. So if people go to altitude, they experience a loss of muscle mass. Certainly when they're there for multiple weeks, it's actually well established that people lose muscle mass, like 10 to 15%. And it's not only undernutrition, it's also purely the hypoxia, so the lack of oxygen, which is fascinating. So I looked into the enzymatic pathways that are leading to this. And then I followed my tutor at that time, or at least someone who was a collaborating with. Katrien de Bock, she was able to start her own laboratory in Zurich at ETH, one of the best universities in the world. So it was an easy choice for me to follow her and to actually kind of start with her the laboratory of exercise and health, where I mean, we can talk about this, but I kept studying muscles and which factors actually affect muscle health and how muscles grow, or also how muscles reduce in size, for example, in aging.
Was there an initial spark that ignited your interest for muscles in particular? Maybe an injury, or maybe you had other issues with muscles, or was it simply something because like with when you play golf, I assume golf is more about skills and not so much about muscle mass and power.
Yeah, this is kind of an idea that has been floating around with people who are not really involved in the golfing world. But this is, of course, to some extent true. But since the birth or the coming of Tiger Woods, he changed the whole game. So in let's say 1998, he came into the scene and he was powerful, muscular. He hit the ball 40 yards further than the rest of his competitors.
Okay.
And that was a part of his genetics and a part of because if he trained really hard, like actual like how athletes train. And indeed, before it was the fat guys with a cigar
that
played the game. But now it has completely professionalized. So golfers are considered athletes. They do explosive movements. They do a lot of strength training because it's a massive advantage to hit the ball further. Even if you hit it 5 to 10 yards further, it's a huge advantage. So this, of course, is now the last 15 years happening with also other players. So this was interesting for me because I was starting doing some fitness during my times in the golfing world. And then Tiger Woods was also really at the top of his game. So that was one of the sparks. And also just the fact that I was involved in sports during my university time. I mean, of course, muscles is what move the body, is what also what I learned is also, are contributing to the fountain of youth. If you are healthy, you probably are have healthy muscles or vice versa even. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there are now more and more studies showing that muscles are really, you have to look at it as an organ, like the liver, like other organs that produce hormones that could be healthy for the brain. So by doing exercise, you actually produce hormones that could be healthy for other organs as well.
Okay.
That's very important.
Okay.
So that's why exercise also is healthy on the long term. Not only because you keep your muscles healthy, but also because you keep the other organs healthy because of the exercise.
Now, before we go into the muscle science in particular, what does a day in the life of an exercise and health scientist at ETH look like? Do you teach? Do you do research? Is it a mix of both? Perhaps you could also tell us a little bit what kind of research you're doing right now or have been doing in the past.
Yeah, so it's a combination of both. I actually come just back from a lecture. I gave a lecture this morning, exercise physiology to master students at ETH, where we talked about wearables and how to improve your fitness with wearables, for example. And then, so that's a small part, let's say 6 to 8 hours per week of preparation, and then also giving the lectures 2 hours per week. And then also doing the actual experiments. So as a postdoc or a PhD, you are allowed a lot of freedom from at least my boss, Katrien. She tells you, okay, we have to go in that direction. And then you go into the lab. We do a lot of mouse experiments, experiments with humans, mostly in my PhD, now less, and also experiments with cells. So
okay.
you can we have actually the whole arsenal of tools at our availability at ETH, where we can study specific molecules, where we can study specific proteins, how they affect the muscle. So we actually do the experiments, and then also we write the manuscripts. We think about how to added to a nice, let's say, paper. And then we make the figures and we send it out to academic publishers. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it all works. And that's our main job to, let's say, generate information for society.
You mentioned mice. It would be interesting. Do animals basically have sort of like the same or a similar muscle build up to humans?
Yeah, so it is. Yeah, so mice are very interesting because this immediately makes me think about fiber types. So maybe you've heard about humans. We have basically two types of fibers, muscle fibers, I mean, the fast twitch, so the explosive athletes, and then the slow twitch fibers. And human muscle is very heterogeneous, meaning that you have mostly 50-50. For example, you take your quadriceps, you take a cross-sectional biopsy, and you see around 50% scattered around the whole muscle. With mice, it's a little bit different. They have specific muscles that are predominantly type 1, so slow fibers, and specific muscles, most of the muscles actually, are very explosive. So more the posterior muscles, such as the soleus, one of the calf muscles, is a very slow muscle. And that's interesting as a scientist because then you can look at the effect of, for example, amino acids of exercise specifically to one specific fiber type. In humans, it's also possible you can take out one specific fiber and then measure it in the lab. But on the whole muscle level, you likely have a very heterogeneous mix. For example, that's a strong difference between animals and humans. But there's very much close connections. For example, they have a similar digestive system. Mm-hmm. So if you would provide them proteins such as whey or vegan proteins such as pea rice protein, the digestion and the appearance of the amino acids in the blood will be quite similar to humans. So that's also an advantage we can then use, for example.
Also, how does the brain muscle connection in animals? Because obviously they have a different cognitive system or function. So like, how does that work with animals? Do they know, like humans, okay, I need to strengthen my muscle or I need to move in a different way? Or like, how do they learn to move? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a very good question because, first of all, I don't know the exact answer. I'm not a neuroscientist, but I think one of the interesting differences between the let's say the sedentary human now that doesn't do too much activity, takes the car, takes the train, and doesn't walk too much or doesn't do exercise, compared to a mouse is quite different because a mouse is kind of born to run. Meaning that maybe also a human, but at least they don't do it anymore. They don't have the motivation anymore. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do I mean with that? So what we use is as a model of exercise in mice is voluntary running. So we take a wheel, a little wheel, and we put it into the cage. And we don't do anything. We don't say anything. We don't stimulate anything. We just put it there. The mice ran. They run 8 kilometers a night. A mm-hmm. night. 8 kilometers, which is tremendous amount, right? Just voluntary. In humans, it's different. So the motivation to exercise is actually a very interesting topic that I think is fascinating. And one professor is actually doing research on it. Is why do mice, run? Why do they choose to go to that wheel and run? And why do most humans not do this? That's kind of the intriguing question, because if we can get people to or motivate them to do more exercise, I think then that would be already be better for many diseases, cardiovascular diseases, for example.
I also wonder how that works with babies, toddlers, little children who are probably more animal like in the sense of cognitive functions. When they begin to move, when they crawl or like when they like try to get up, is that basically done by imitation, whatever they see that their parents do? Or is it something intrinsically that tells them, okay, I have to get up, I have to move, or like... Do you know how that works?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly how that works. It's not really in my expertise, but it is absolutely true that people, that it, young kids are much more active. I mean, just de facto, from how they move, they play much more. And if we take that away, it's a very big disadvantage for them growing up. For example, now with the screens, what you see that people use an iPad as a babysitter, I think it's a really bad trend in society.
Yeah.
And it's something we should actively fight against because the movement, this also has to do with one of my research topics. There's a high likelihood that movement in childhood and in adolescence has a larger impact, even epigenetically, at a later age, right?
Absolutely.
And not only just learning, meaning the motor control, learning how to bike, learning how to walk, right? But also actually intrinsically in the muscle, that there are certain pathways altered, certain biochemistry that is altered due to the movement at early age, that is actually, even when you have a long period of sedentarism, for example, during your 20s, if you then start again at your 30s, you have an advantage. So this is early stage, and it's not really shown in humans, but it has been shown in mice, this muscle memory effect.
It's really interesting when you mentioned that more and more small kids are also stuck behind phones and tablets. I had a preschool teacher who told me that it is indeed a big problem. You know, they have a lot of kids who barely know how to move. They have balance issues.
Yes.
They don't know how to jump across a log or across a fence.
Yes.
It is a very, very important topic for sure.
Yes. Question is how to change it. That's always a question. We know that's a problem, but it's not so easy to change the society there.
Now, going back to the cognitive thing, what exactly is the skeletal muscle connection? What is the importance? How does this function work, and how does it promote health? How do they impact each other?
What do you exactly mean with the skeletal muscle? So with the bone and the muscle, or with the brain and the muscle, or
with the brain and the muscle, or like how the muscles impact the skeletal?
The bones.
Yes, the bones, or vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, so we did a study in mice, quite interestingly, where we had, so that's why also people also always ask, like, why do you use mice? Why don't you use just humans, right? Like, it's better, but some things you just can't research in humans. It's just a fact. Mm-hmm. One of the things is, not entirely, but aging, for example. There are models in mice where we manipulate one specific gene and they have some kind of accelerated aging. So it is very expensive to wait 3 years before a mouse is very old. It has to be caged for 2.5 years. It's not nice for the mouse. Of course, it has to be in a cage for 2.5 years. So there's some ethical questions there. But if you can accelerate the aging in 1 year, they're, let's say, senile, they're hunched, they get gray hairs and so on, that's quite interesting. And one of the things we did is we phenotyped those mice and we checked many of the effects of chronological aging. And you saw there that, when the mice did not exercise, also the bone formation and the osteoporosis was much worse in those mice.
Oh, just so, humans, huh?
Yeah, so similar as humans. So there must be the most important connection there, and that is also known, is that if you do exercise before you're 30, 35 years old, so load-bearing exercise, meaning not cycling, actually the opposite of cycling, rather running or CrossFit or jumping or whatever, the load, so the actual mechanical load that is transferred from the muscles or from the ground to the bones makes the bones, let's say, more healthy, more dense, and so forth. So, and this kind of deteriorates when you are 35, it starts to go down, and it's hard to, maybe you can kind of counteract it or diminish it, but you cannot like completely keep going up. Right,
right, right.
And that's also why, for example, cyclists, elite cyclists, I know yourself are an amateur cyclist, or have been, they actually have big issues with osteoporosis.
Oh. Okay.
Because they, like, it's a massive problem for them because they never do
muscle.
Any steps, right?
Yes.
They avoid flights of stairs at any cost. They do only non-weight-bearing exercise. And this even, so that's why you need the impact of the ground as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So cycling enough would, in that case, not be enough, right? So it's always a balance.
I was actually, that was one of my other questions as well, but
yes.
Maybe we can touch on that a bit later on. The cardiovascular activities
yes.
versus strength
yes.
training, you know, there's always, and I myself, unfortunately, I also lean more toward cardiovascular
mm-hmm.
activities as a next cyclist, maybe. But in general terms, first, maybe, what is considered good muscle health? How do I know if I have healthy muscles other than knowing, okay, I can bench press so
yes.
many kilos
yes.
pure
performance.
But how do you measure good muscle health?
Yeah, so it's a very good question, and I think we're at the point that only performance or predominantly performance is a good correlation to muscle health. So what do I mean with that? It's not only, for example, muscle mass. Pure, if you look at the muscle mass, it's not a direct determinant of muscle health.
Mm-hmm.
You could have some edema, you could have non-functional proteins there, you could have some fibrotic tissue. But if you have like sufficient amount of strength, independent of the mass, that's a very good, let's say, parameter of muscle health.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on the age, you say bench press, but people who are 60 or 65 years old,
yeah.
doing five times a squat on a chair, going on the chair and off the chair, if you are able to do this, there are specific tests for this. This is a relation of muscle health. There are also some biochemical factors and some blood factors that you could measure, and that's more related to muscle damage, right? So what if the muscle is really unhealthy? That you could probably measure. But for example, creatine kinase fluctuations in the blood. But the most important thing is that you have some kind of performance with your muscles, and that you can do specific strength exercises and also endurance exercises at an average level, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And how do you support muscle health, especially as you get older, and the loss of muscle, obviously,
yes.
Which is a big issue with aging people. And now, of course, as people have a life expectancy of like at least 90,
yes.
I think
yes.
anyone born after 2000
That's
has
crazy.
A life expectancy of like 120,
yes. Yes.
I think.
I don't know, but it is high, yeah.
It will be interesting to see like if muscle health also kind of like sets in, or like aging muscles, if that also sets in at a later age as well, or
the key point is here, you need mechanical load, so you need weight bearing exercises on the muscle. That is something that is really well known in the 60s. They did some beautiful studies with rats, and they want to know what is actually the main driver of muscle hypertrophy. Right, we back in the 60s, they of course didn't know much. Right, they thought, yeah, if you do some farming, you probably get strong arms, but they didn't know anything about resistance training. So what did they do? They actually they had rats, and they stimulated specific nerve in the body to maximally contract the foot. So of course you cannot ask a rat to maximally contract whatever, right? They maximally contract the foot, and then they looked at specific muscles. So they looked at the muscles at the front side of the shin bone, the tibialis anterior, and they also looked at the calf muscles. And if you fully contract all the muscles of your, let's say, lower leg at the same time, the strongest muscles will, let's say, win, and the segment, the foot, will actually go in the direction that the strongest muscles pull. And this is what happens with the calf muscle. The calf muscle is stronger than your muscles at the front of the shin bone. So because the calf muscles contracted maximally and the front, so the tibias anterior, also contracted maximally, but actually extended during that contraction, right? It experienced much more mechanical load, mechanical tension. And interestingly, what they saw is that only the tibialis anterior, so the front, increased in size after 8 to 10 weeks. And then they did another experiment where they actually put some weight to the foot. So also the gastrocnemius, so the calf muscle, was loaded. And then they saw both muscles hypertrophy, right? So this means that if you would just do some kind of endurance training or low load-bearing exercise, mm-hmm. you probably don't get any muscle hypertrophy or, let's say, adaptations to that. So that's the key point, is you need some kind of load, relative load. A bodybuilder will need more load mm-hmm. than someone who is 50-year-old and never has done any exercise. They can use resistance bands, they can do some steps, whatever, right? So it has to be a high relative load that fatigues the muscle. Mm-hmm. That's important here. And that's how you keep your muscles, let's say, healthy at a longer age, okay. at an older age.
In terms of muscle health and strength training, there is also the issue of like overtraining, I guess, your muscles. And I think that is something we see at the gym.
Yes.
All the times you have these yes. men and women do weight training like every day. Obviously, not always training the same muscles, but still, like, how do you know when it's like too much, other than like having, you know, sore muscles or like your joints start to hurt?
Yes. So, yeah, this is... This is, of course, a very, very individualized question, I would say. Some people can handle much more training load than others. So, for example, I think that one of the main determinants of how you react to a training plan is how well you can handle the load. Right? Some people just genetically can do four times a week train the same muscle group and be perfectly fine. Some need only two. So, first of all, find a good coach. Find someone who understands your individual body, and that actually asks you, how do you feel? So one of the better determinants to do this is to track how you feel right after and maybe 2 hours after the training. Meaning, it's called RPE, so it's relative subjective, like your subjective feeling. You can do from 6 to 20 or from 1 to 10. And that's... Science have shown that's actually quite a robust and a good way to measure how much, load and how you feel after a training. And that's it's important. Mm-hmm. That's important. So, yes, you really need to make sure that you recover well after a training. Because, of course, it's a typical thing that we always say, but the actual adaptations occur in the recovery period. Mm-hmm. And if that recovery period is too short, again, depending on the individual, then, and also of the nutrition kind of, then you won't adapt, and you can train as much as you want, you won't adapt, right? Mm-hmm. So you cannot exactly know. Some people say, yeah, maybe you can use DOMS, so the soreness of the muscle. Mm-hmm. But in any case, if you train long enough, there's a reduction in soreness in any case, right? So it's not the perfect marker. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's maybe the inverse marker, because if you would train once a week, only once a week, really hard your legs, you will always every week be sore. Mm-hmm. But if you train three times a week, the soreness goes away because mm-hmm. the muscle adapts. That's kind of how it works.
How much do genes play into the amount of muscle mass? Is that very individual, or like it seems some people do have more muscle mass than others?
Yeah, so it's kind of a black box. So we don't really know. That's a very short answer. We know, like, let's keep it like this. Yes, they have a strong influence, but we don't know which gene clusters actually specifically affect this. It's not so easy to investigate. Why do I say this? There's been beautiful studies also 20 years ago where they did, they had 200 families, so around 600 people, 700 people, and they let them do strength training supervised in the laboratory exactly the same training. So they did bicep curls for 12 weeks. And everyone, every individual did the same amount of training, right? Same. And then they saw, they checked the amount of muscle mass gains over those 12 weeks. And there was a huge variability. Some people lost muscle mass, literally lost, and some gained 30%. So it and importantly, this spread was less variable within the family, meaning that genes are important. So if your brother gained 20%, you gained probably 17%. If your brother gained 0%, you also have a higher chance to also gain 0%. So this shows clearly that genes are involved. But it's not so easy to know, okay, these genes are the ones we should target. And that's kind of the, I think, the next step within the next 10 years in sports sciences is to understand which genes are important, how can we potentially pharmacologically affect these, and how can we design training plans to also get the non-responders to respond better to training, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? These are open questions, I would say.
How does nutrition play into this? I mean, obviously, everybody knows protein.
Yes, yes.
Is, but is there other types of food or like that promotes muscle?
Yeah, so if you think about, if you just go to first principles of muscle mass gains or even just strength gains and muscle health, it all situates around the net protein balance. So what does it mean? You have structural proteins, let's say the most important proteins, actin and myosin, that literally drive the contractions of the protein of the muscle. Right, and if you want to have more muscle mass or more mass in your tissue, you want to have more of those, literally more mass. So you need to synthesize more of those actin and myosin and other structural proteins. Mm-hmm. And two major external factors drive this. One, load, strength training, mm-hmm. literally loading the muscle.
Yeah.
Second, protein or amino acids. Right. And interestingly, we know now the last 6-7 years, also based on my research, that they independently stimulate protein synthesis independently. But if you add them together, it's a synergistic effect. Mm-hmm. So you do strength training. And then afterwards, we all know you drink your whey shake or you eat a steak or you eat some vegan protein, right? Why do you do this? You want to stimulate muscle protein synthesis to the maximal extent, and you want to do it in a synergistic way that they both stimulate your synthesis of proteins because the muscle wants to adapt. So we talked about recovery. For example, if you would do strength training or even endurance training, and you don't eat sufficient amount of protein in relatively close proximity to your training, then this will not lead to better recovery, actually decreased recovery, because the protein synthesis is not maximized, you see? And if you increase your protein synthesis compared to your protein breakdown over a long period of time, you will gain, for example, muscle mass or tissue strength.
Okay. Does protein always equal protein? I mean, obviously, yes. You know, the big one is, you know, the animal
yes.
versus
yes.
plant-based.
Yes.
But also within animal protein, is it basically the same if I eat an egg or if I have a chicken breast?
Yep.
And then also now I've been noticing that at supermarkets, grocery stores, everything has added protein now. I mean, you have protein bars, you have protein pudding, you have protein...
Everything.
Cookies. Is there a difference in terms of like quality of protein? Let's say if I do have a protein bar,
yes.
is it basically the same quality protein that I get from an egg or a chicken?
So, yeah, that's of course a kind of a hot topic and a bit, I think, overstated topic. But I will definitely can you give you some input there. So yes, there's a difference in protein quality. And protein quality is majorly defined as how well can you digest the protein? How fast do the amino acids get broken down?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the proteins get broken down into amino acids, one. And two is how much leucine there is in the whole mix of amino acids. So leucine is one of the 20 amino acids that for some reason nature has decided to make that the trigger of protein synthesis. So we did some studies in cells, actually quite interesting studies, where you could provide all the amino acids or nearly all the amino acids and nothing happens with protein synthesis. But if you give leucine specifically, it gets sensed by specific enzymes, the sestrin and LRS, and those signal towards the muscle, hey, we have sufficient leucine, we can start doing the muscle protein synthesis now. So quality of protein depends on leucine, how much there is, and how fast the leucine, let's say, can get absorbed and get into or get sensed by the muscles. And there it has clearly been shown that animal proteins have more leucine, like, let's say, 8% or 7% in good, relatively good quality vegan proteins, but 11%, for example, in whey protein. So it is a slightly higher leucine content. But that doesn't mean that vegan proteins have no leucine or they're completely bad quality always. No, no, they just have less leucine, right? So that's one of the points. The thing is also that, as I said, it's a little bit overstated to like mark this protein all the time, because we simply, studies have shown that if you do resistance training and you eat sufficient amount of protein, which has reasonable quality, which may be some animal protein or high quality vegan proteins, and you reach a certain point to around 1.6 grams per kilogram per body weight per day. So I weigh 85 kilograms, this would be 190 grams, which is easily attainable without any supplements, right?
How much is that in terms of, like, is that one egg? Is it certain?
Yeah, so one egg has 8 grams of protein, okay. And you need 190. So this is like around 4 to 5 meals of 40 grams of protein spread throughout the day. So it's depends a little bit. Some people easily attain this. Some people need one more snack or a quark or some whey shake. But it's relatively easy to get to. You don't have to eat burgers all day. Really not. Okay. Right? And above that, if you go above that, there's no additional effect of the protein. Because, of course, the muscle protein synthesis, it can be maxed out as well. You cannot go forever up. You see? So that's why if you just eat 1.6 grams per kilogram body weight per day, if it is a bit more vegan, if it is a bit more animal-based, and you do a well-structured training plan, for example, for muscle hypertrophy, you will be fine. Okay. The extra gains will be very, very marginal with the protein quality.
Is there such a thing as too much protein? In other words, can it get to a level where it becomes unhealthy?
It's a big debate. It's hard to say. Some epidemiological studies where they followed people who ate high proteins, they have mentioned that it might be bad for certain cancers or certain diseases. Okay. But again, you can never causally tell this is like the effect of protein. What is maybe one of the myths that can be debunked here is that kind of, no matter how much protein you eat in one meal, let's say 800 grams of protein in one meal, they all get absorbed. Mm-hmm. It's not that I cannot digest them or something. Yeah. It's just too much to maximize my protein synthesis. That's important. But the amino acids will be available. They will be oxidized in the liver. They will be actually transferred into fat because there's an energy surplus. But you can absorb them. That's okay. Important.
I'm asking because, like with, for example, vitamin D and C, you can actually get too much when it becomes unhealthy.
Yes. In the protein world, they have done some kidney function studies, and there is very little like negative effects. It's the same with creatine supplementation. You can have like tons of creatine, tons of protein. The kidneys are, if they're healthy, they're well equipped to actually handle this. But again, why would you do it? There's no reason. No additional benefit of eating 3 grams per kilogram body weight. Mm. Maybe bodybuilders, really at the elite, crazy end of the spectrum. But every healthy human being shouldn't overdo it with protein. There's no need.
Or people seeing a bar at the grocery store and assume, oh, wow, you know, it's a protein bar. It's probably good for me in some way.
it might be good if you do high load and high amount of resistance training and you really want to gain muscle, that it might be useful. But for 99% of the people, it's not useful. Mm-hmm. It's marketing.
In terms of like evolution, I just wonder when you would look at history of human beings, like how have it muscled evolved over times? Have there been like study? I mean, obviously, you know, we get bigger and faster and stronger, like every generation, it seems. Has that changed because of nutrition or because people are more active or?
Yeah, maybe there's an evolution indeed in if you look at just athletic performance, right? Over the last 150 years, let's say, or 130 years from the 1900s when they start measuring this. For example, in explosive sports, there's a very clear trend that from the 1985, there's a clear leveling off. So there was an initial nice linear phase that we always threw for further. We could jump higher and so on. But there's a leveling off. We clearly are reaching the plateau of human performance, clearly. The marginal gains are there, but it's less. So I would argue we're actually going the opposite direction. I'm not so sure we are our muscles getting healthier over the generations, because simply the inactivity prevalence is higher and higher. You can see this in kids, in 15-year-olds. There are studies also in Belgium that the physical activity amount and also just the performance is going down, right?
Interesting.
And yeah, this is the effect. And maybe the elite athletes, if you train them well with the right technology, they can still get the marginal gains. But I would argue that the physical fitness of the average population is going down. It clearly... the physical activity is going down for sure. Physical fitness, and therefore linked, of course, to physical performance. Mm-hmm. So, I don't think it's going in the right direction, actually, on average. And that's, I think, a problem for society within the next 100 years, for sure.
Interesting. I wonder if there are environmental reasons for that as well, you know, and nutrition, obviously.
More processed
foods.
Yeah, it's always the interesting thing is like it's always nutrition. It's always nutrition. But I always try to look at it from the other side. I honestly think it's more movement. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's more processed food. Yes, there's more seed oils. Yes, it's not always that healthy. But it's also very clearly that people are just not moving anymore, almost or much less. And that's a key problem in society now. And yeah. As long as we keep everything more automatic, it's not going to improve. I know this as well. Mm-hmm. So, that is something that bothers me, honestly.
Well, in terms of movement and exercise, what are your thoughts of, like, let's say, for somebody who just wants to be healthy and have fun at working out?
Yep.
We mentioned CrossFit in our pre-discussion. I think this is something also that you're interested in, or like, you know, gym activity versus CrossFit outside.
Yeah, so for sure, one of the most important things is exercise adherence. So can you keep doing it? Most important thing. The rest is, let's say, preference. But there are studies showing that there is more, to your point, there's more people that doing aerobic activities than strength bearing or strength training activities.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
I mean, it's easier, I guess. I don't know
it's a
why
bit
that
easier,
is. But.
It's a little bit easier. Yeah, exactly. And the latest reports I've seen is like 32% of, depending where you look at, for example, in Romania, no one does exercise, for example. I saw this funny. But like Western countries like Switzerland and Belgium, 32% do sufficient amount of aerobic exercise. But 5% do enough strength training. That's really nothing. So So that's why I would call people to also get engaged in some kind of load-bearing exercise, because it's so crucial for later life. At this point, if you're young, you probably won't feel too much and it's probably fine. But if the muscle is not conditioned at later age and you never did any like relatively heavy strength training, then you might run into problems. Mm-hmm. CrossFit is a way to doing this because it's just efficient, you just go there. There is always a strength part in it. It's not only endurance, and it's a combination literally of both, which has been shown to actually, there is an interference between, so you won't become an elite athlete in cycling anymore. Let's say your goal is to cycle, then you shouldn't do whatever 10 hours per week of strength training. There is an interference. But for most people, they don't want to become the next Fabian Cancellara, right? They want to be healthier. And if you want to become healthier, you clearly have to incorporate some form of resistance training. Mm-hmm. And that is something that people neglect too much. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you just have to start going. Like, inaction is the worst. Nothing happens. So action is what you need.
Are there statistics like how much muscle mass that you lose, let's say, when you don't work out at all, like a month maybe?
The muscle is an extremely plastic organ, meaning that indeed it can go up and down very, very fast. So we did some studies, not myself, I was not involved, but in my laboratory with casts, so where they put the leg into a cast and literally no movement. Mm. And then you see 5%, 4% per week, right? So again, load is important here, because even when you just move, it's not high load, but it's movement, it keeps my arm same circumference, right? But if I just stop moving it by putting it in a cast, even though I'm completely healthy and I eat sufficient amount of protein, goes down, right? Mm-hmm. So there needs to be activity, simply. And
Is it true that you shouldn't do weights and cardio within the same sort of like session or day?
So this is the thing, what your goals are. If you are, let's say one spectrum, you're a CrossFitter. You want to be best in both areas, mm-hmm. right? You want to be maybe not the best marathon runner, but a good marathon runner. And you don't want to be a power lifter, but not the best, but like 90%. Then I would say you need to separate the sessions as much as possible, minimum 6 hours. So some mm-hmm. beautiful studies in rugby players where they did no separation, 1 hour separation, 6 hours and 24 hours separation of the strength and endurance sessions. And then they saw no interference anymore at the 6 hour time point.
Okay.
Right? So rugby is comparable to CrossFit, for example. Mm-hmm. That said, that's good for 0.5% of the population who wants to excel in both areas. The rest of the world should just do them at the same hour. Mm-hmm. There isn't, as I said, there is some interference because of the molecular pathways that are actually inhibiting each other. But it is, on the grand scheme of things, a marginal effect, because the only goal, or the most important goal of exercise, I think, is fun, performance and health. Mm-hmm. And the performance will be slightly less than, but the fun will be better. And also it's much easier for most people to do it in 1 hour, right? You cannot just easily do two sessions a day. I mean, it's just not very feasible. Mm-hmm. Don't worry too much about that.
Okay. And with age, I mean, I'm in my late 50s, I have to admit, unfortunately. So how important it does become strength training and supporting your frame, basically?
Yeah, very, very, very important. So you really can, there are studies in master athletes. So that's always an interesting group, because then you can look at the effects of aging per se, kind of independent of exercise, because that's always a thing. People say, I'm 35 years old, when they become a dad, for example, because of aging, my muscle mass goes down, my body composition is deteriorating, and so on. I said, it's just because of lack of exercise. It's not because of aging. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in master athletes, you can see this because they keep doing exercise, right there, whatever. Powerlifters, master powerlifters. Until 60, they do heavy lifting every other day. Still there, you see decline in strength. Mm-hmm. So there you can look at, okay, this is probably purely aging, right? And there is a decline in strength, but 1-2% per year. But it is much slower, this decline, than someone who doesn't do exercise. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So instead of finding excuses, it's my age, it's just lack of exercise, mm-hmm. most of the times.
Is that part of that biological age also, the more you move and exercise, that you can actually reverse your biological age?
Exactly. Reverse, you can just... Then it's always like, what is the control? Is the control in these studies a person who never does any exercise and just ages? Or should the control be the people who remain active? You asked about evolution. I mean, clearly people remained much longer active than now, previously. Right, so yes, it's a combination of you don't really reverse, you just delay the aging process.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That you also could see in our mice, these accelerated aging mice. If you put them on a wheel, even when they have a specific gene that increases mutations and increases aging, this is delayed with exercise, with endurance exercise. Very interesting. Instead of when they just sit in a cage for the whole life.
What do mice eat, by the way? I just realized.
Mainly carbohydrates.
Like, how do they gain? I mean, are they carnivores or
no? No. They eat chow, like dry squashed wheat and like carbohydrates mostly.
Oh, okay.
Mostly.
Okay.
Yeah. So they just these dry pellets. They eat. Mm. They don't eat meat. They like cheese. So they like the animal protein, I guess, and the fats. They're like humans. They like the processed stuff. They also like creams. People make them fat by eating them in creams. I don't think they eat meat, actually.
Well, and finally, I think this is something important. I think really how to bring a more scientific approach into the mainstream, especially with, you know, all the misinformation online and on social media. What's your take? What are your solutions?
The only solution is to provide better information and attract more followers, not actively fighting misinformation. I don't think it works. Or maybe, but then on your platform that you have a little bit more credibility. So and the mainstream is also because there's a lot of misinformation or misinformation, just not correctly stated information, mostly about nutrition, because I think the major problem with nutrition is that it's very hard to do intervention studies, like clear intervention studies. For example, are avocados healthy? Mm-hmm. Question. Very difficult to look at from a scientific point of view, because you would have to do kind of an intervention study where you have thousands of people that come into the lab, have a certain diet, and then this diet is supplemented with avocados or not with avocados, right? And this you cannot do. It's too expensive. People won't come to the lab. It's very, very hard. So what people do now, like most of the nutrition sciences, is they just look at two groups. One group eats avocados. One does not eat avocados. Mm-hmm. And then they check, mostly look at it, and they say, the blood parameters and the body composition of the avocado eaters is better. So the mainstream media puts it causally, saying avocados are healthy. Mm-hmm. It's not the right way to do it, because it could be that there could be some confounding factors, and it's very hard to control for them. Mm-hmm. For example, the avocado eaters are from a higher socioeconomic class. They eat better in general, or they do more exercise, right? So it's just very hard with nutrition science to have a causal effect, and that's why just the misinterpreted information just comes into the mainstream media. It's not only the journalists' fault, I think, but it is confusing for the people.
It is.
But
do you think universities perhaps should play a more active role in promoting science in the mainstream?
It's a very good question. It's an issue in universities. So maybe I can talk about this quickly. 4 years ago, I was exactly struggling with this question. So I was doing science, I think applied science, quite interesting science for general public, the effect of exercise, the effect of sports sciences, right? And I was thinking many people would actually benefit what I read, what I do. So, yeah, the university doesn't really spread this information. It just, they they teach their students, which is 100 people, 200 people or so, but not, of course, the public. And I think it's actually a service of the university to actively educate or try to educate in a nice manner the public about what has been found, like in a good way, not putting out a blog on the ETH websites that literally no one reads, right? This is just a fact. So what I just did, I said, screw that. I will just start my own science communication page called What Science, Workout of the Day. And we're just going to read interesting papers that we always do in our work and try to explain them in 5 to 6 slides for normal people. And clearly there was a niche for this because this took off like crazy. We have like 110,000 followers now. Really a lot of people are interested and in asking, hey, this is cool what you guys do. So there's a need. And universities, they don't really do this. And I find this interesting. I honestly think they should have one researcher per research group, 50% paid to actively try to explain science from the group to the public. I think this is one of the things they could do instead of letting some PhDs doing maybe less interesting work. They could actually try to get them out on social media, get them out on YouTube, have a good platform. And it doesn't really happen. There's no incentive. I don't really understand why. I've never been contacted. Also, I mean, as I said, we have quite some reach, and no one at university cares too much, although they should, in my opinion. But that's
My view. I took a look at your platform, and it's absolutely amazing. There is a lot of information about exercise and fitness, and you are welcome to let our listeners know what the exact link or page is on Instagram or web page, whatever you want to share with us.
Go ahead. It's very simple. It's WOD, what, and then science on Instagram. And we now recently also launched a site, internet site, where you can what-science.com, easy findable on Google, where you can find like an archive of all our posts. So that's, I think, quite interesting, is that people come around and every day we get DMs. It's like, hey, you posted something about how to maximize your strength gains in CrossFit or something. But we couldn't find it in the feed because there's no search function. Mm-hmm. So now we have this on the site. You can just log in and find those posts. You can searchable as well. So it's a hobby. As I said, I'd never been paid by the university to do this. It was all during the evenings and when I had time to actually make these posts. And I think it's important as a scientist it's an important job as a scientist, and it's not done enough.
Yes. It's an incredible platform, and we will spread the word as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, it's been truly interesting. Almost 1 hour, I think, or
time flies.
More than an hour. I had a lot of fun. Thank you
so much
for coming again.
Thank you, Peter.
And perhaps at some point we can have part two.
I can always come back and talk about a specific study or something that could be interesting for your listeners.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.